Bowser. But the deliberate, simple-minded, and sickeningly effective trick of that highway-lining curtain of trees makes him want to smack someone. Every mile of it dupes his heart, just like they planned. It all looks so real, so virgin, so unspoiled. He feels like he's on the Cedar Mountain from that Gilgamesh, which he found back in the ranch library and read to the horses last year, the forest from the first day of creation. But it turns out Gilgamesh and his punk friend Enkidu have already been through and trashed the place. Oldest story in the world. You could drive across the state and never know. That's the fury of the thing. In Eugene, Douglas converts a hefty tower of silver dollars into a ride in a small prop plane. Just take me in the biggest circle you can make for the money. I want to see what down here looks like from up there. It looks like the shaved flank of a sick beast being readied for surgery. Everywhere, in all directions. If the view were televised, cutting would stop tomorrow. Back on the planet's concealing surface, Douglas spends 3 days on his buddy's couch, mute. He has no capital, no political savvy, no golden tongue, no economic sophistication or social wherewithal. All he has is a clear cut in front of him, whether his eyes are open or closed, haunting him all the way to the horizon. He makes some inquiries. Then he hires out his 1.5 good legs to a contractor, planting seedlings back into the stripped lands. They kit him out with a shovel and a Johnny Appleseed bag filled with seedlings, for which they charge him a few pennies each. And for each planted tree that's still alive in a month, they promise to pay him 20 cents. Douglas fir, America's most valuable timber tree. So, sure, why not grow a tree farm full of nothing but 5 new houses per acre? He knows he's slinging trees for middlemen to the same fuckers who cut down the primordial gods to begin with. But he doesn't have to vanquish the lumber industry or even get nature's revenge. He just needs to earn a living and undo the look of those cuts. A look that tunnels into him like a beetle into sapwood. He spends his days traversing the silent, slop-filled, sloping dead zones. He drags himself across the scattered crap on all fours, losing his footing in the impenetrable slash, hauling himself forward by his claws over the chaos of roots, sticks, branches, limbs, stumps, and trunks, fibrous and shredded, left to rot in a tangled graveyard. He masters the art of 100 different ways to topple. He stoops, makes a little wedge in the ground, stuffs in a seedling, and closes the hole with a loving nuzzle from his boot tip. Then he does that again, and again, in starbursts and scattered nets, up hillsides and down denuded gullies, dozens of times an hour, hundreds of times a day, thousands by thousands every week, until his whole throbbing 34-year-old body puffs out like it's filled with viper venom. Some days he'd saw off his gimpy leg with a file if he had one handy. He sleeps in tree planter camps filled with hippies and illegals, tough, lovable people too tired at day's end to bother much with talk. A saying comes to him as he lies down at night, stiffened with pain. Words he once read to his charges in his prior life as a ranch hand. If you're holding a sapling in your hand when the Messiah arrives, first plant the sapling, and then go out and greet the Messiah. Neither he nor the horses could make much of it. Until now. The smell of the cuts overwhelms him. Damp spice drawer. Dank wool, rusty nails, pickled peppers, scents that return him to childhood, aromas that inject him with inexplicable happiness, smells that plunge him down to the bottom of the deepest well and hold him there for hours. Then there's the sound, like his ears are wadded up with pillow, the snarl of saws and feller bunchers somewhere in the distance. A great truth comes over him. Trees fall with spectacular crashes, but planting is silent, and growth is invisible. Some days, dawn breaks in Arthurian mists. There are mornings when the chill threatens to kill him, noons when the heat knocks him on his semi-numbed butt, afternoons so profligate with blue he lies on his back and stares upward until his eyes water. There come mocking and merciless rains, rain the weight and color of lead, shy rain, auditioning with stage fright, rain that leaves his feet sprouting moss and lichen. There were huge spiked skeins of interwoven wood here once. They will come again. Sometimes he works alongside other tree slingers, some of whom speak no language he recognizes. He meets hikers who want to know where the forests of their youth have gone. The seasonal pineros come and go, and the hardcores, like him, keep on. Mostly, it's him and the brute, blank, stripped-down rhythm of the work. Wedge, squat, insert, stand, and boot-tip seal. They look so pitiful, his tiny Douglas firs. Like pipe cleaners, like props for a train set. From a distance, spread across these man-made meadows, they're a crew cut on a balding man. But each weedy stem he puts into the dirt is a magic trick eons in the making. He rolls them out by the thousands, and he loves and trusts them as he would dearly love to trust his fellow men. Left alone, and there's the catch, left alone to the air and light and rain, each one might put on tens of thousands of pounds. Any one of his starts could grow for the next 600 years and dwarf the largest factory chimney. It could play host to generations of voles that never go to ground and several dozen species of insects whose only desire is to strip their host bare. Could rain down 10 million needles a year on its own lower branches, building up mats of soil that grow their own gardens high in the air. Any one of these gangly seedlings could push out millions of cones over the course of its life. The small yellow males, with their pollen that floats across entire states, the drooping females with their mouse tails sticking out from the coil of scales, a look he finds dearer than his own life. And the forest they might remake, he can almost smell, resinous, fresh, thick with yearning, sap of a fruit that is no fruit, the scent of Christmases endlessly older than Christ. Douglas Pavlicek works a clear-cut as big as downtown Eugene, saying goodbye to his plants as he tucks each one in. Hang on. Only 10 or 20 decades. Child's play for you guys. You just have to outlast us. Then no one will be left to fuck you over. Nile Mehta. The boy who'll help change humans into other creatures is in his family's apartment above a Mexican bakery in San Jose, watching tapes of the electric company. In the kitchen, his Rajasthani mother chokes on clouds of ground black cardamom that clash with the cinnamon of pan fino and conchas trickling up from the bakery below. Outside, in the Valley of Heart's Delight, the ghosts of almond, cherry, pear, walnut, plum, and apricot trees spread for miles in every direction, trees only recently sacrificed to silicon. The Golden State, the boy's parents still call it. The boy's Gujarati father, comes up the stairs, balancing a massive box on his broomstick body. 8 years before, he arrived in this country with $200, a degree in solid-state physics, and a willingness to work for 2/3 of his white colleagues' salaries. Now he's employee number 276 at a firm rewriting the world. He stumbles up 2 flights underneath his load, humming his son's favorite song, the one they sing together at bedtime. Joy to the fishes in the deep blue sea, joy to you and me. The child hears his steps and rushes to the landing.
Peter, what is it? A present for me?
He's a 7-year-old little Rajput who knows that most of the world is a present for him.
Let me come in first, Nile, please, thank you. A present, yes, for both of us.
I knew it!
The boy goose-steps around the coffee table, hard enough to clack the steel balls on the pendulum toy.
A present for my birthday, 11 days early.
But you have to help me build it.
The father nurses the box onto the table, pushing the clutter to the floor.
I'm a good helper.
The boy counts on his father's forgetfulness.
And that will take patience, which you are working on, remember?
I remember,
the boy assures him, tearing at the box.
Patience is the maker of all good things.
The father steers his son by the shoulders into the kitchen. Mother barricades the door.
Don't come in here. Very busy. Yes, hello too, Moti. I got the computer kit.
He tells me he got the computer kit.
It's a computer kit? The boy shrieks. Of course you got the computer kit. Now you two boys go play. It's not exactly playing, Moti.
No? Go work then, like me.
The boy yips and tugs at his father's paw, pulling him back to the mystery. Behind them, the mother calls out,
1,000 words memory or 4?
The father blossoms,
4. 4,000, of course. Now go away and make something good.
The boy pouts when the green fiberglass backplane comes out of the box.
That's a computer kit? What use is that?
His father grins the most foolish grin. The day is coming when use will be rewritten by this thing. He reaches into the box and turns up the heart of the matter.
Here it is, my Nile. Look!
He holds up a chip 3 inches long. His head wags with pleasure. A look dangerously like pride spreads across his ascetic face.
Your father helped make this one.
That's it, Peter. That's a microprocessor? It's like a bug with square legs.
Oh, but think what we managed to put inside.
The boy looks. He remembers his father's bedtime stories from the last 2 years, tales of heroic project managers and adventuring engineers who suffer more mishaps than the white monkey Hanuman and his entire monkey army. His 7-year-old brain fires and rewires, building arborized axons, dendrites, those tiny spreading trees. He grins, cagey but uncertain.
Thousands and thousands of transistors!
Ah! My smart little man.
Let me hold it.
Ch-ch-ch. Careful. Static. We could kill this fellow before he even comes to life.
The boy blooms with luscious horror.
It's coming to life?
If...
The paternal finger wags.
If we get all our sodders right.
Then what will it do, Dad?
What do you want it to do, Nile?
In front of the boy's widening eyes, the component turns into a djinn.
It does whatever we want?
We just have to figure out how to get our plans into its memory. We're putting our plans in there? How many plans will fit?
The question stops the man, as simple ones sometimes do. He stands lost in the universe's weeds, hunched a little from the stronger gravity of the world he visits. Someday, it may hold all the plans we have. His son scoffs.
This little thing?
The man scrambles up to the bookshelf, takes down the family scrapbook. A few flips, and he calls out in triumph, "Hi, Nile, come see." The photo is small, green, and mysterious. A tangle of giant boa constrictors pour out of broken stone.
See, na? A tiny seed fell on this temple roof. After centuries, the temple collapsed under the seed's weight. But this seed just keeps going and going.
Dozens of braided trunks and roots feed on the ruined walls. Tentacles drip down to fill the chinks and split stones open. A root thicker than Nile's father's body creeps across a lintel and seeps like a stalactite into the doorway beneath. This vegetable probing horrifies the boy, but he can't look away. There's something so animal in the way the trunks find and follow the openings in the masonry. Like those other kinds of trunks, the trunks of elephants, they seem to know, want, find their way. The boy thinks, something slow and purposeful wants to turn every human building into soil. But his father holds the photo in front of Nile as if it proves the happiest destiny.
You see, if Vishnu can put one of these giant figs into a seed this big,
the man leans down to pinch the tip of his son's pinky.
Just think what we might fit into our machine.
They build the box over the next several days. All their solders are good.
Now, Nileji, what might this little creature do?
The boy sits frozen by possibility. They can release any process they want into the world, any kind of willful thing. The only impossible thing is how to choose. His mother calls from the kitchen,
"Teach it to cook the bindi, please."
They make it say, "Hello, world," in flashing coded lights. They make it say, "Happy birthday, Nile dear." The words that father and son write arise and start doing. The boy has just turned 8, but in this moment, he comes home. He has found a way to turn his innermost hopes and dreams into active processes. Right away, the creatures they make begin to evolve. A simple 5-command loop expands into a beautiful segmented structure of 50 lines. Little portions of program detach into reusable parts. Nile's father hooks up a cassette tape player for easy reloading of their hours of work in mere minutes. But the volume button must be set just right, or everything explodes with a read error. Over the course of a few months, they graduate from 4,000 bytes of memory to 16. Soon they leap again to 64.
Peter, more power than any human has ever had to himself in all of history.
The boy loses himself in the logic of his will. He housebreaks the machine, trains it for hours, like it's a little puppy. It only wants to play. Lob a cannonball over the mountain onto your enemy. Keep the rats out of your corn harvest. Spin the wheel of fortune. Seek and destroy every alien in the quadrant. Spell the word before the poor stick man hangs. His father sits watching what he has unleashed. His mother bunches up her blouse tails in her fist and berates all males within earshot.
Look at the boy. He just sits and types. He's like a sadhu, stoned on something. He's hooked, worse than pan chewing.
His mother's hectoring will go on for years, until her son's checks start rolling in. The boy never stops to answer. He's busy making worlds. Small ones at first, but his. There's a thing in programming called branching, and that's what Nile Mehta does. He will reincarnate himself, live again as people of all races, genders, colors, and creeds. He'll raise decaying corpses and eat the souls of the young. He'll tent high up in the canopies of lush forests, lie in broken heaps at the bottom of impossibly high cliffs, and swim in the seas of planets with many suns. He'll spend his life in the service of an immense conspiracy, launched from the Valley of Heart's Delight, to take over the human brain and change it more than anything since writing. There are trees that spread like fireworks, and trees that rise like cones, trees that shoot without a ripple, 300 feet straight skyward, broad, pyramidal, rounded, columnar, conical, crooked. The only thing they do in common is branch, like Vishnu waving his many arms. Among those spreaders, the wildest are the figs, strangler trees that slip their sheaths around the bodies of others and swallow them, forming an empty cast around their decomposed hosts. People, ficus religiosa, the Buddha's bow, their leaves tapering into exotic drip tips. Banyans that plump out like whole forests, with 100 separate trunks fighting for a share of the sun. That temple-eating fig in his father's photo inhabits the boy. It will keep on growing faster with each new chunk of reusable code. It will keep on spreading, searching the cracks, probing all the possible means of escape, looking for new buildings to swallow. It will grow under Nile's hands for the next 20 years. Then it will flower to become the boy's belated thanks for an early birthday present, his homage to skinny little Peter, lugging that massive shipping box up the apartment stairs, his praise to Vishnu, known only through cheap newsprint Hindi comic books he could never read, his farewell to a species turning from animal into data, his effort to raise the dead and make them love him again. So many trunks growing downward from the same tree. The seed his father plants in him will eat the world. They move into a house down the valley along El Camino in Mountain View. 3 bedrooms. Such luxury confuses Babul Mehta. He still drives a 20-year-old car, but every 5 months he upgrades the computers. Ritu Mehta panics each time a new crate arrives. When does it end? You're pauperizing us! The garage fills with so much old gear the car won't fit. But every component, however outdated, is a marvel of mind-boggling complexity created by a team of heroic engineers. Neither father nor son can throw even these obsolete miracles away. The snail's pace of Moore's Law tortures Nile. He's starved for more RAM, more MIPS, more pixels. Waiting for the next barrier-breaking upgrade takes a tenth of his young life. Something inside these tiny, mutable components is waiting to get out. Or rather, there's something that these reticent things might be made to do. Something humans haven't even imagined yet. And Nile is on the verge of finding and naming them, if he can only find the next new magic words. He skitters through the schoolyard like a traitor to childhood. He learns the shibboleths, the famous refrains from countless sitcoms, the hooks of pernicious little radio tunes, the bios of 15-year-old sexpot starlets he's supposed to be slayed by. But at night, His dreams fill not with playground battles or the day's takedown gossip, but with visions of tight, lovely code, doing more with less. Bits of data passing from memory to register to accumulator and back, in a dance so beautiful he can't begin to tell his friends. They wouldn't know how to see what he put in front of their eyes. Every program tunnels into possibility. A frog tries to cross a busy street. An ape defends himself with barrel bombs. Under those ridiculous blocky skins, creatures from another dimension pour into Nile's world. And there's only the narrowest window of time in which to really see them, before these things that never were turn into things that have always been. In a few years, a kid like him will be given cognitive behavioral therapy for his Asperger's and SSRIs to smooth out his awkward human interactions. But he knows something certain before almost anyone else. People are in for it. Once, the fate of the human race might have been in the hands of the well-adjusted, the social ones, the masters of emotion. Now, all that is getting upgraded. He still binges on old-school reading. At night, he pores over mind-bending epics that reveal the true scandals of time and matter, sweeping tales of generational spaceship arcs, domed cities like giant terrariums, histories that split and bifurcate into countless parallel quantum worlds. There's a story he's waiting for long before he comes across it. When he finds it at last, it stays with him forever, although he'll never be able to find it again in any database. Aliens land on Earth. They're little runts, as alien races go, but they metabolize like there's no tomorrow. They zip around like swarms of gnats, too fast to see, so fast that Earth seconds seem to them like years. To them, humans are nothing but sculptures of immobile meat. The foreigners try to communicate, but there's no reply. Finding no signs of intelligent life, they tuck into the frozen statues and start curing them, like so much jerky, for the long ride home. His father is the only person Nile will ever care for more than he cares for his creations. They understand each other, with no words spoken. Neither of them is happy unless they're sitting at a keyboard together. Cuffs of the neck and pokes in the ribs, teasing and giggles, and always that gentle, head-tilted, sing-song lilt. Watch out, Nileji, be careful, don't abuse your powers. The whole wide universe waits to be animated. Together they must create possibilities out of the smallest atoms. The boy wants scales and songs, but his machines are mute. So Nile and his father create their own sawtooth waves, clicking the little piezo speaker on and off so fast it starts to sing. His father asks, "How is it that you have turned into a creature of such concentration?" The boy doesn't answer. They both know. Vishnu has put all of living possibility into their little 8-bit microprocessor, and Nile will sit in front of the screen until he sets creation free. In middle age, the boy will be able to drag a cute icon and drop it into a tree diagram, producing, in one flick of the wrist, things that took him and his father 6 weeks of evenings in the basement together to create. But never again, this sense of the inconceivable waiting to be conceived. In the redwood-trimmed lobby of the multi-million-dollar office complex, paid for by a galaxy right next to this one, he'll hang, for many years, a plaque inscribed with the words from his favorite author. Every man should be capable of all ideas, and I believe in the future he shall be. 11-year-old Nile
makes his pita a kite for Uttarayan, the great kite festival. Not a real kite, something better, something the two of them can fly together without anyone in Mountain View thinking they're ignorant cow worshippers. He tries out a new technique for animating sprites he read about in a mimeographed hobby magazine called Love at First Bite. The idea is clever and beautiful. You rough out the kite in different sprites, then poke them directly into video memory. Then you shuffle them onto the screen like a flipbook. The first little flutter makes him feel like God. His brainstorm is to write the program so that it can itself be programmed. Let the user key in the melody of his choice, with simple letters and numbers, then make the kite dance to that rhythm. The grandeur of the plan spins Nile's head. His pita will set his own kite dancing to a real Gujarati tune. Nile fills a loose-leaf binder for the project with notes, diagrams, and printouts of the latest version. His father picks up the binder, curious.
"What is this, Mr. Nile?"
"You don't touch that one."
His father grins and bobs. Secrets and gifts.
"Yes, Nile, my master."
The boy works on the project when his father's not around. He takes it to school, that maze of halls full of organized torture that will inspire many a dungeon crawl of his later making. The black notebook binder looks official. He pretends to take notes in it while working on his code. His teachers are too flattered to suspect. His plan works like clockwork until fifth period. American literature, with Ms. Gilpin. The class is reading Steinbeck's The Pearl. Nile kind of likes the story, especially the part where the baby gets stung by the scorpion. Scorpions are outstanding creatures, especially giant ones. Ms. Gilpin drones on about what the pearl symbolizes. To Nile, it's a pearl. He's beating his head against a real problem, how to synchronize the dancing kite with the music. He flips through pages of printout when the solution jumps out at him. Two nested loops. It's like the gods draw it in bright chalk on his mind's blackboard. He burbles to himself, "Oh, yeah!" The class bursts out laughing. Ms. Gilpin has just asked, "No one wants to see the baby die, do they?" Ms. Gilpin daggers everybody silent. "Nile, what are you doing?" He knows not to say a word. "What's in the notebook?" "Computer homework." Everyone laughs again at the insane idea. "Are you taking a computer course?" He shakes his head. "Bring it here." Halfway through the journey up to her desk, he considers tripping and spraining his ankle. He hands over the notebook. She flips through it. Drawings, flowcharts, code. She frowns. "Sit down." He does. Ms. Gilpin returns to Steinbeck while he soaks in a pool of injustice and shame. After the bell, when the room clears, he returns to Ms. Gilpin's desk. He knows why she hates him. His kind will drive hers extinct. She opens the notebook to grids filled with images of blocky kites. "What is this?" She has no idea of Uttarayan, or what it's like to have a father like his. She's blonde, from Vallejo. Machines are her enemy. She thinks logic kills everything fine in the human soul. "Computer stuff?" "You're a smart boy, Nile. What don't you like about English? You're so good at diagramming sentences." She waits, but can't outlast him. She taps the notebook. "Is this a game of some kind?" "No." Not the way she means it. "Don't you like to read?" He feels sorry for her. If she only knew what reading could be.
The Galactic Empire and its enemies are sweeping across the entire spiral of the Milky Way, waging wars that last for hundreds of thousands of years, and she's worried about those three poor Mexicans.
I thought you liked A Separate Peace.
He liked it enough. It even punched him in the lungs a little. But he can't see what that has to do with getting his private property back.
Doesn't the Pearl interest you? It's about racism, Nile.
He stands blinking, as at his first contact with alien intelligence.
Could I just get my notebook back a little? I won't bring it to class anymore.
Her face crumples. Even he can see how he's betrayed her. She thought he was in her camp, but he has slipped away from her over the weeks and turned enemy. She touches his notebook and frowns again.
I'm going to hold on to it for now, until you and I are back on track.
In a few years, students will shoot their teachers over less. He goes to her office at the end of the day. He fills his mind with sincere reform. I'm very sorry about working in my notebook when you were teaching.
Working, Nile? Is that what you are doing?
She wants a confession. She wants him to thank her for saving him from the perils of playing games while all the rest of the class was hard at work extracting fiction's pearls. 50 hours of effort on his father's kite lies 4 feet away, unreachable. She wants to humiliate him. Outrage boils over.
May I have my damn notebook back, please?
The word slaps her. Her eyes set, and she goes to war.
That is a demerit. You swore at a teacher. What will your parents say?
He freezes. His mother will fell him with one great blow, like so much jutka meat. Miss Gilpin checks her watch. Too late to send him to the principal. Her boyfriend is picking her up in 10 minutes. They'll laugh together over the pig-headedness of this Indian boy with his notebook full of hieroglyphs, how he insisted that it wasn't play. She turns into a pillar of authority.
I want you back at this desk tomorrow morning before the first bell. Then we'll talk about what you have coming to you.
The boy's blood hammers and his eyes burn.
You may go.
Her eyebrows do a little push-up of command. Until tomorrow, 7 a.m. sharp. He needs to think. He skips the bus and heads home on foot. The day is one of those eerie Central Peninsula imitations of heaven. 70 degrees and clear. The air thick with bay laurel and eucalyptus. He drags along the familiar route at half his usual pace, past the modest middle-class bungalows that people will soon pay $1.5 million for just to tear down and rebuild. He has to make a plan. He swore at a teacher, and his old golden life shatters in the single terrible syllable. This disrespect of white people will cripple his father. Patience, Nile. Reserve. Remember? Remember? Word will spread through the community of Indian expats. His mother will die of disgrace. He walks along the fingerprint whorl of tree-lined streets, that neighborhood hemmed in by 3 highways. 4 blocks from home, he cuts through the park, the place he goes whenever his parents force him outdoors. The path snakes through a gauntlet of low-slung encinas with phantasmagoric branches, growing since California was Spain's remotest outpost. If he's ever noticed the species at all, it was only in the movies. The trees of Sherwood and Bagworthy stand in forests to frighten pilgrims and challenge castaways. When Hollywood needs trees, it turns to the only nearby broadleaf that will do. They beckon, bizarre, dreamlike, contorted. One huge beam of branch swoops toward the ground like it's lying down to rest. A single swing, and from that low branch, Nile shimmies up into the roost, where he sits like he's 7 again. There he takes stock of his ruined life. From high up in this crazy cantilevered oak, looking down on the sidewalk where two kids swing a stick at pebbles, and a humpbacked white-haired woman walks her dachshund, he can see this whole mess from Miss Gilpin's eyes. She wasn't wrong to reprimand him. And yet, she stole his property. The whole disaster from up in this crow's nest has what Miss Gilpin might call moral ambiguity. He makes room on the oak's sinuous branch for the two boys from a separate piece. He watches them play their white guy prep school games of love and war in their tree above their river. Way below, the brown-green California ground bounces each time a breeze pitches the branches. He knows almost nothing of his parents' world. But one thing is as certain as math. Shame, for Indians, is worse than death. Miss Gilpin may already have called them with details of his crime. His head throbs at the thought, and his tongue tastes metal. He hears his mother howl, "You let that rat-haired woman humiliate your whole family?" Soon a distant country filled with aunts, uncles, and cousins will know what he has done. And his poor father, who has made himself invisible for years just for the right to live and work in this golden state. He stares at Nile in horror, wondering how a child might be so arrogant as to think that he could talk back to an American authority and live. Nile peers down from this oak eyrie onto the path below, his mind a mass of tangled code. An idea flashes through him, a glimpse of easy peace. If he could get dusted up a little bit, it might win him the sympathy vote. You can't beat up on a wounded boy. Delicious terror strokes his neck, like it does when he watches old Twilight Zones. The idea is nuts. He must suck things up, go home, and take his punishment. He leans out for a good look at the big picture, his last for a while. His parents will ground him for months. He sighs, steps down onto the branch below him to descend, and slips. There will be years to wonder whether the branches jerked, whether the tree had it in for him. Limbs slam him on the way down. They bat him back and forth like a pinball. Earth rushes up. He lands on the concrete path and bounces on his coccyx, which cracks the base of his spine. Time stops. He lies on his shattered back, looking upward. The dome above him hovers, a cracked shell about to fall in shards all around him. A thousand green-tipped splitting fingerlings fold over him, praying and threatening. Bark disintegrates. Wood clarifies. The trunk turns into stacks of spreading metropolis, networks of conjoined cells pulsing with energy and liquid sun, water rising through long thin reeds, rings of them banded together into pipes that draw dissolved minerals up through the narrowing tunnels of transparent twig and out through their waving tips, while sun-made sustenance drops down in tubes just inside them. A colossal, rising, reaching, stretching space elevator of a billion independent parts, shuttling the air into the sky and storing the sky deep underground, sorting possibility from out of nothing. The most perfect piece of self-writing code that his eyes could hope to see. Then his eyes close in shock, and Nile shuts down. He wakes days later in the hospital, strapped down and viced. Tubes restrain his arms and legs. Two wedges press against each ear, arresting his head. He can see nothing but ceiling, and it isn't blue. He hears his mother shout, "His eyes are open!"
He can't understand why she keeps sobbing those words like they're a bad thing. He lies in a cloud of narcotic unknowing. Sometimes he's a string of stored code in a microprocessor bigger than a city. Sometimes he's a traveler in that country of surprise that he'll come to build, when machines are at last fast enough to keep up with his imagination. Sometimes monstrous, splitting tendrils come after him. The itching is insane. Every spot above his waist is unreachable fire. When he drops back down to earth again, his mother is there, curled up in the chair next to his bed. A change in his breathing wakes her from her sleep. His father is there, too, somehow. Nile worries. What will his employers say when they discover he's not at work? His mother says, "You came down out of a tree." He can't connect the dots.
"Fell?"
"Yes," she argues. "That's what you did."
"Why are my legs in tubes? Is that to keep me from breaking things?"
Her finger wags in the air, then touches her lips.
"Everything will be fine."
His mother doesn't say such things. The nurses ease him by degrees off the pain drip. Anguish sets in as the drugs dry up. People come to see him. His father's boss, his mother's card-playing friends. They smile like they're doing calisthenics. Their comfort scares the crap out of him. "You've been through a lot," the doctor says. But Nile has been through nothing. His body, perhaps. His avatar. But he? Nothing important in the code has changed. The doctor is kind, with a tremor when his hand drops to his side, and eyes that fix on a blank spot high up on the walls. Nile asks,
"Can you take the vice things off my legs?"
The doctor nods, but not in agreement.
"You have some mending to do."
"It's bugging me not to be able to move them."
"You concentrate on healing. Then we'll talk about what happens next."
"Can you at least take off the boots? I can't even wiggle my toes."
Then he understands. He's not yet 12. He has lived for years in a place of his own devising. The thought of countless good things passing out of his life doesn't quite occur to him. He still has that other place, the heaven in embryo. But his mother and father, they fall apart. Awful hours set in, days of disbelief and desperate bargaining that he won't remember. There will be years of supernatural solutions, alternative practices, and miracle cures. For a long time, his parents' love will make his sentence worse, until they finally put their faith in moksha and accept that their son is a cripple. He's still lying in the traction bed, days on. His mother has stepped away on an errand. Maybe not by chance. His teacher comes through the doorway, all warmth and energy, prettier than he remembers.
"Miss Gilpin! Whoa!"
Something goes wrong with her face. But then people's faces always look wrong from his new vantage place, underneath them. She comes near and touches his shoulder. It freaks him.
"Nile, I'm glad to see you." "I'm glad to see you, too."
Her whole torso trembles. He thinks, "She knows about my legs. The whole school knows." He wants to tell her, "It's not the end of the world." No crucial world, anyway. She talks about the class and what they're reading now. Flowers for Algernon. He promises to read it by himself.
"Everyone misses you, Nile."
"Look,"
he points to the wall, where his mother has taped the giant fold-out card signed by the entire 9th grade. She breaks down. He's helpless to do anything.
"It's okay,"
he tells her. Her head jerks up, crazy with hope. Nile. You know, I never thought...
I know, he says, and wants her gone. She pushes her face back with two splayed palms. Then she reaches into her satchel and retrieves his notebook. The kite program for his father.
This belongs to you. I should never...
He's so happy he doesn't even hear the words she keeps on mouthing. He thought the notebook was gone forever, another thing he'd never get back from his life before the tree dropped him.
Thank you. Oh, thank you so much.
A moan comes out of her. When he looks up, she turns and runs. Distress lasts only until he opens the notebook. Then he lies flipping through the recovered pages, remembering everything. So much work, so many good ideas, saved. 6 years pass. Puberty transforms Nile Mehta. The boy shoots up into a fantastic creature, 17 years old, 6'6", 150 pounds, and fused to his wheelchair. His torso stretches out. Even his legs, shriveled to thick twigs, grow stupidly long. His cheeks shift like continental plates, and his face spawns shoals of pimples. Black wires sprout from his once pristine privates. He drops from soprano to high tenor. His hair grows as long as a keshe-practicing Sikh's, though he doesn't tie it up into a rishi knot. He lets it flow in thick vines that fall all around his elongated face and down his bony shoulders. He lives in his rolling metal rig. Captain's chair on a starship forever voyaging through strange regions of thought. Some people who can no longer walk grow fat. But those people eat. He gets through the day on 50 cents of sunflower seeds and 2 caffeinated sodas. Of course, he rarely spends a pointless calorie. Once he rolls up to his custom desk in the morning, his CPU tower and CRT need more power than he does. His fingers graze the keyboard, and his eyes scan the screen, but his brain burns considerable glucose as he fashions his prototype creations in 18-hour increments, command by careful command. Stanford accepts him 2 years early. The campus is just up El Camino. Its CS department flourishes, fertilized by extravagant gifts from the founders of his father's company. Nile has haunted the campus since the age of 12, long before he starts school as an official freshman. He's a de facto mascot of the computer science set. You know, the ectomorph Indian kid in the fancy chair? Something is being born in the bowels of half a dozen different buildings across the farm. Magic beanstalks erupt everywhere, overnight. It comes up in conversation with friends, in the basement computer lab where Nile hangs out and codes. They can be a taciturn bunch, but on Sunday nights, the coders lift their heads from their do-loops long enough to dole out the liter soda bottles and break pizza crusts together while shooting a little philosophical shit. Someone says, "We're evolution's third act." Sauce dribbles from his gaping mouth. It's like they all have the idea together. Biology was phase one, unfolding over epochs. Then culture throttled up the rate of transformation to mere centuries. Now there's another digital generation every 20 weeks, each subroutine speeding up the next. Chips doubling their transistor count every 18 months? I mean, take Moore's Law seriously, man. Say it holds for the rest of our lives. We could live another 60 years. A giggle passes through them at the insane math. 40 doubling periods. Stratosphere-high piles of rice on the fabled chessboard. A trillion-fold increase. Programs 1,000,000,000 times deeper and richer than the best thing anybody's yet written. They pause for sober marveling. Nile hangs his head over his untouched pizza, staring at the wedge as if it's a problem in analytic geometry. Living things, he says almost to himself. Self-learning. Self-creating. The whole room laughs, but he doubles down.
So fast, they'll think we're not even here.
At first, the point of coding is to give everything away. Pure philanthropy. He'll find a marvelous seed program in the public domain. Then he'll flesh it out, add new features, switch on his 1200 baud modem, dial into a local bulletin board, and upload the source for anyone who wants to grow it some more. Soon his creatures propagate on hosts across the planet. Every day, people around the globe add new species to the repositories. It's the Cambrian explosion all over again, only a billion times faster. Nile gives away his first masterpiece, a turn-based romp where you play a Japanese movie monster eating its way across the world's metropolises. Hundreds of people in a dozen countries grab it, even at 45 minutes per download. So what if playing it does to your free time what the monsters do to Tokyo? His second game, Conquistadors Ravaging the Virgin Americas, is another freeware hit. A Usenet group forms just to trade game strategies. The program generates a new, geologically realistic, new world each time you play. It turns any grocery store bag boy into Stout Cortez. His games spawn imitations. The more people steal from him, the better Nile feels about his chair-bound life. The more he gives away, the more he has. From his vantage, stranded in his wheelchair in a basement lab, whole new continents swing into view. The gift economy, free duplication of well-shaped commands, promises to solve scarcity at last, and cure the hunger at the heart's core. The name Nile Mehta grows mini-legendary among the pioneers. People thank him on dial-up boards and in game news groups. College kids talk about him in chat rooms as if he's some Tolkien character. On the Internet, nobody knows you're a beached, elongated freak, unable to move without machines. But by his 18th birthday, paradise is sprouting fences. Former philanthropists of free code start taking out copyrights and making actual coin. They even have the nerve to form private companies. Granted, they're still just peddling floppy disks and baggies, but it's clear how things will go. The commons are getting enclosed. The gift culture will be throttled in the cradle. Nile blasts the betrayal at each week's meeting of the home-rolled club. He spends his free time recreating one of the most famous commercial offerings, improving on it, then releasing the clone into the public domain. Infringement? Maybe. But every one of the so-called copyrighted properties relies on decades of prior unpaid art. For a year, Nile plays Robin Hood, camped out in the anarchic forest with his merry men under a massive oak older than the deed to the land it grows on. He works for months on a role-playing space opera slated to be his greatest giveaway yet. The graphics are 16-bit high-res sprites, come to life in 64 glorious colors. He heads out on a hunt for surreal bestiaries to populate his planets. Late one spring evening, he winds up in the Stanford main library, poring over the covers of Golden Age pulp sci-fi magazines and flipping through the pages of Dr. Seuss. The pictures resemble the mad vegetation in those cheap Vishnu and Krishna comics from his childhood. Needing a break, he rolls across campus down Sarah Mall to see what's cooking in the labs. It's near dusk, in that soft perfection that flavors this place for 9 months of the year. He heads toward his cubicle in the networked lab, navigating as through a first-person adventure. The oval's grandiose palm arcade snakes away to his right. To his left, the Santa Cruz Mountains peek out from behind the fake Spanish Romanesque cloisters. Once, in another life, he walked the trails up near Skyline under the redwoods with his father and mother.